Hi there, welcome to Hey Lesson, the podcast where we underhandedly teach you things through the lens of popular video games. I'm Brendan Caldwell, and I'm here to ask clever people silly questions, but I'm also here to talk about video games. Today we're going to talk about Planet Zoo, which is a management game where you build your own zoo and you fill it with animals while trying to keep your guests happy, your enclosures well staffed, your lions satisfied. Very soon we're going to hear from a real zookeeper, and they'll tell us what it's like to actually take care of polar bears, how animals come to be in a zoo, and the unlikely friendships formed by cheetahs in captivity. First, however, we always have a guest co-host on Hey Lesson, and this time it is Games Journal novelist and noted animal liker, Nate Crowley. Hello, Nate.
Hey, Brandy, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Not bad. Not bad. Staring into the cloudless blue sky like the villain at the end of Sun. Was it called Sunshine, the movie where the madman stares at the sun? It's like that, but not sinister, basically. What I'm saying is I'm enjoying the summer.
You're the right person to talk to about this stuff, okay, for multiple reasons. But Planet Zoo, the PC game, has been out for a couple of years now. But just in case any listeners don't know much about it, can you tell them exactly what Planet Zoo is and what you do in it?
Yeah, sure. So it is, first of all, if you've ever experienced Planet Coaster, another park management game by Frontier, it's very similar in terms of format. If you haven't, you start with, you know, either a blank map or one with some scenery on it or a scenario map, and you have an astonishing toolkit with which to build a zoo. And I mention that because I think, other than the simulation of the animals, which is probably the best I've seen in a game, what I really like about Planet Zoo is how much creative freedom it gives you with construction. You have all these hundreds and hundreds of little bits, you know, either architecture bits or plants or rocks or whatever, and you build it from the ground up. You know, you can go into minute detail and you're making, surprise, surprise, habitats into which you put animals. And then, like, little fellas come and pay to be amazed by them. And I wouldn't say it is the most heavy duty management game, because it has got that big aesthetic focus on lovely animated beasts and on freeform sandbox construction, but you know, it's a decent management game. It's got solid mechanics, and it's something I have dumped hundreds of hours of my time into since it came out.
This is partly the reason why I wanted you on for this episode, but also because you have worked in a zoo before.
I have, yeah. Not for a long time now, but in my early 20s, I gave talks at the London Aquarium and a little bit of animal stuff there. And a little bit later than that, I worked at weekends in the education department at London Zoo, where one of my jobs at the weekend was to look after their menagerie of animals, and I'd get to take them around the zoo, take them out to schools and things like that. That was a belter, that was.
We're going to talk a little bit more about both the game and your experience with animals as well. First, as I said, we've always got an interview with an expert on the show, and this week I spoke to Matthew Price, who is a zookeeper in California, and he told me what it was like working with animals every day. Quick note, there's a small bit of construction work happening in the background of this call, so sorry about that, but it's not that much. The important thing is that we're going to learn some animal facts. So here's what Matt had to tell us. Matthew, firstly, could you tell us who you are and what you do for a living?
Yeah, I'm a zookeeper. I have been working in the zoo industry for the last 21 years. Just hit that mark in April. I've worked at zoos like the San Francisco Zoo, where I've started. I've also worked at Disney's Animal Kingdom in Orlando, Florida. After that, I worked at the Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle. And currently, I work at a very famous zoo in the southwestern United States in Southern California. So I can't actually say that, unfortunately, the name of that zoo, but I'm sure you can figure it out.
And do you specialize in any specific type of animal?
I am kind of a generalist. Most recently, I've been working with a lot of carnivores like polar bears, lions, jaguars, and things like that. But if you can think of a taxa of animals, I've probably worked with them at some point in my career. Everything from elephants all the way down to like invertebrates like bugs and stuff. But currently with the bigger scary guys, the carnivores and the large hoofstock like tachin and zebra and larger gazelles and things like that.
Being a zookeeper, what does that involve day to day?
I start work at 6 a.m. We get out at 2:30, so I'm up at 4:30 in the morning, which is extremely early, especially for somebody who throughout most of his life has been kind of a night owl. Usually, in non-COVID times, we would all of the keepers on staff for that day on that particular team would meet up. We'd discuss the day, what's going on, is there any moves, are there any vet procedures, anything that needs to be happening. And then we go into doing what we do call morning checks on our animals in the areas that we're working. So we'll walk around, basically making sure everybody's alive and well. And then we get into the real meat of our day, which usually starts with cleaning and feeding the animals. Throughout the day, we'll be doing like keeper talks and presentations for the public, because a big part of our job now, as opposed to zoos in the past, is education. We're also educators in this field. A lot of people go into taking care of animals because they don't like people or don't do well with people. So there's a lot of introverts in the field, but more and more we're figuring out that we are also like frontline educators, because people, they want to know about the animals, they want to see the animals, if they can interact with the animals, they want to do that, because it's tough to make people care about something that they can't, see and interact with, or at least learn something about, right?
I'm going to ask you, and I want you to be honest, how much of your career so far has been spent cleaning up poop?
Usually about 4 to 6 hours a day times 21 years. So that's a lot of poop that gets cleaned up. I can tell you that our elephants specifically, there's several hundred pounds of poop that gets picked up a day just from those animals.
What's the best animal to work with if you're a zookeeper?
That kind of depends on your, what you want to do. For me, it's polar bears. Like I'm kind of a bear or a dog kind of guy. Like I kind of feel like I understand them and they understand me. Cats are kind of the opposite end of the spectrum for me. I don't really understand them that much, and they don't really seem to necessarily understand me. So it just kind of depends on what you work. There are people that are really into working with primates. That's also, I've done it. I've worked with great apes like gorillas and orangutans, but for me, it's not the work that I want to be doing. You have the really weird people that are just super into bugs and they want to be an insect zookeeper, bird keepers are kind of a unique breed as well. You kind of, when you meet somebody in the zoo field, you can often tell what kind of keeper they are based on their personality interactions, and bird keepers have a very distinct personality in general. So best is kind of a difficult question to answer, but for me, I would say polar bears and larger carnivores.
In the video game that we've been playing, Planet Zoo, you get new animals by, you sort of find them in a big list and you click, oh, buy the lemur or buy this timber wolf. You're essentially ordering them from a catalog. But how does a real zoo get their animals?
That's a really good question. So, ideally you are replenishing your collection from the animals that you have. You have a successful breeding herd or a breeding pair, if it's a like a larger like carnivore type animal or something like that. But the goal is also to keep the gene pool robust. You don't want brothers and sisters breeding. You don't want mothers and sons breeding, that kind of thing. So there is a system in the zoos called the Species Survival Plan. Someone that's ahead of that list, basically, and what they're doing is they are matching up animals within the zoo community. We're mixing animals around, so like we'll send animals to other zoos, we'll get other animals to come in, and it's different for every type of animal, right? The other way that we can get animals still, and this generally refers to invertebrates and you know, animals that are not endangered. Sometimes we will still collect animals from the wild. That doesn't happen anymore in terms of like the charismatic megafauna. Like, we're not just bringing an elephant out of the wild to have it in a zoo. If that is the case, then it's usually a problem animal. I can tell you one quick story from San Francisco Zoo. We had a polar bear there that was from Alaska. I think she's probably passed on at this point, but she was from Alaska, and she was a problem bear. She kept coming into this small town in Alaska and, you know, basically going into the dump, eating garbage, and you can't have a polar bear running around your town, right? So they would sedate it, take it away about 100 miles in a direction, and then it would come back to the same town. That happened 3 times. So there's you have, you know, really only a couple of options with animals like this. You either put them into a managed care setting, like in a zoo, or you probably are going to have to destroy that animal because it's going to be a significant risk to human life. And in those interactions, the animal, unfortunately, is always going to lose. Another situation, the two of the three polar bears we have at my current zoo, they were orphans from their mother. So it is still legal for native people in Alaska and in places in Canada to hunt polar bears. So in this situation, a hunter killed the mother. Didn't know that he had any cubs, but found out after the fact, saw the cubs, called an organization that was able to come in and rescue them. And polar bears will stay with their mom for about 2 to 2.5 years, and they learn how to do everything from their mom, including swimming. So these are pretty much helpless bears at this point.
Oh my God, either that's need heartbreaking.
So like there's really no other option other than to put them into a managed care facility because they're not going to survive on their own. In fact, the two bears I'm talking about learned to swim in the pool in the children's zoo. So they literally learned how to do everything from people at a very young age. I think they came into our zoo at 3 months old, so very young.
And how are those animals physically transported? Are they shipped from place to place? Like, are there special restrictions across countries? Like, if one was traveling from one country to another?
Oh yeah, there's all kinds of permits and paperwork to sign and. I've taken animals to the airport before in crates. You got to deal with like the normal crate and baggage people. All of a sudden they're lifting a crate with a jaguar on it, and they want to look in the thing, stick their fingers in there, try to get pictures, all this stuff. So you kind of have to stay with them until like they basically go on the plane. And in some instances, the animal has to be able to turn around. You have to be able to secure a water bowl, that kind of thing. Yeah. So there's lots of ways to do it. Ideally, it's going to be ground transportation, but obviously, if it's going overseas, like we've sent animals over to Germany and other places like that. And, you know, it's different for every animal, too. Like when you're shipping something the size of an elephant, you know, you need like a big sea container, basically, to have the animal secure and not hurt itself or not break the shipping container, that kind of thing. So it just depends on the animal.
You also need to feed them the right thing in the video game. In real life, how picky are animals about what they eat? Like, do antelopes turn up their noses at certain grasses?
Absolutely, they do. Yeah, like for our hoofstock collection, our herbivores, we provide multiple types of hay. We have alfalfa and a Bermuda or Timothy, like grass hay, a Sudan hay that's kind of more like straw almost. Every animal has their desire, but we also have a nutrition staff that makes all the numbers work and tells us what we should feed and the amounts that we should be feeding. And, you know, it's great to have that guideline and making sure we're having meeting the nutritional requirements of those animals. But as keepers on the front line, we also see that, you know, just because this nutritionist recommended a certain feed doesn't necessarily mean the animal wants to eat that. So then you kind of have to go back and forth and negotiate with them. And that's different at every zoo. At smaller zoos, maybe they don't have a dedicated nutrition staff and are just going based on what other organizations are feeding. So it's kind of a give and take of what the animal wants to eat and what they need nutritionally to be successful.
So are lions as fussy eaters as house cats are?
Sometimes, yeah. We have, I work less with the lions these days, but I can tell you that our polar bears, like we have 3 different bears and all 3 of them have their favorites and some things that they just flat out will not eat. And then there's other dietary restrictions as well. Like largely their base diet is actually ground up horse meat. And there's a virus called the equid herpes virus, which actually has killed polar bears and bears in general in the past. So we can't even actually feed their base diet. So they make a special beef diet just for our bears. Then that's the only thing that they can eat as their base diet. But then when we throw in enrichment, like things like we'll feed squid sometimes, we'll feed live fish sometimes, we'll feed get lamb carcasses and stuff like that. And so like the male polar bear, he really likes those lamb carcasses, but the two females, they turn their nose up at them. So definitely, even within individual species, you know, the animals have their own likes and dislikes.
You said you worked at Disney for a while. What was that like? You're not keeping Mickey Mouse in a big enclosure, were you?
No, I did, however, work in a show setting at Disney. It was called the Pocahontas and Her Forest Friends show, which doesn't exist anymore. And it was like native North American animals that would go on stage with a professional actress that played the Pocahontas role. So that was kind of a cool show because there were no trainers on stage. And usually in an animal show, there's, you know, a trainer on stage with whatever's happening to direct the animals. But this particular one, we trained, you know, like a raccoon to come out, pick up a sunflower, and then exit across the other stage. So the keepers in that situation would be sending the animal out. They already know the behavior they're supposed to do. And then the keeper on the other side of the stage would come in and pick them up. But that was just one section of Disney. Animal Kingdom. They have big savanna exhibits too, where the keeping is more traditional, like what I'm doing now. It's a very interesting place to work. I would say that I enjoyed my time there, and I'm glad that I went there. But also, it's a whole nother world working for Disney. One of the things that got sent to me when I first found out that I was hired was something called the Disney Lookbook, and that tells you how long, like things like crazy things that you would never even think of, like what kind of sunglasses you can wear. You can't wear mirrored sunglasses. You can't, if you're a man, you can't. I think they've changed this recently, but when I worked there, you couldn't have any facial hair except for a mustache. But if you wanted the mustache, you had to have had it fully grown in, like on a vacation or before you started working there or whatever. Beards were not allowed at all. Females, they tell you, like down to like the millimeter of how long their fingernails can be, what kind of nail polish they can have. The lingo is different. You're not an employee. You're a cast member. You don't wear a uniform. You wear a costume. When you're out with the public, you're on stage. When you're not, you're backstage. So whole different world from that perspective. So I'm more of a laid back guy. There was a lot of rules and stuff to keep up with. So I'm definitely happier somewhere else. But I learned a lot at Disney, and they do a great job. One of the great things about being a zookeeper at Disney is that because they have more money than God, right, you can have basically anything you want for your animals. So you know they're going to be well taken care of and have the best possible facilities and all that stuff. So definitely perks of working there, but the work in general is not for me at Disney. So I'm glad I've moved on.
In the video game, some of the walls and the fences can get into a bad state and they'll fall apart, which means that the animals will escape. So there'll be lions out and about in the zoo. Have you ever encountered any escapees in reality?
I have been a part of very few animal escapes. Luckily, nothing with anything dangerous like lions or tigers or any large carnivores that's actually going to do any damage to me. But you know, we've had gazelles jump out of exhibits before. We definitely have precautions to make that so it's difficult for them to do that. We have, you know, moats that are in front of that separate the wall where the people are watching the animals and where the animals actually are. So they have to get a real, you know, nice running start. In my experience, animals like that, they get out of their exhibit, they're immediately looking to get back in. Like they think it's cool out there, but all of a sudden they realize that everything that they is valuable to them, the food, their friends, shelter, all that kind of stuff is back where they just came from. So, I've seen monkeys escape where they've ended up like sitting on a guest's head. Like jumped on a shoulder, a monkey jumped on a guest's shoulder, and they were able to net it and get it back without, luckily, any harm to that zoo guest. We've had animals like tawkins like bust through gates, like big reinforced gates. A tawkin is like it's a kind of like a big goat-like animal. They're from China. We have the Sichuan version of them. So they're like, you know, can be up to like 1,500 pounds. Big strong animals. They're one of the few herbivores that we are not allowed to go in with because they will just stomp you dead. So we've had animals like that wander out, and they're just hanging out on a hillside, eating grass, laying around, lounging, and you know, they're pretty excited to come back in once they realize that they're out and the food that they want to eat is probably back in their exhibit. So it just kind of depends. Generally, it's not because of degradation of the exhibit in a zoo, because that is part of our daily routine too. I forgot to mention it was making sure our perimeters of each exhibit are secure. So that's not usually an issue. Usually it's something like for the monkey, they're in this giant exhibit that has it's super tall, so they can climb up in the trees, right? So the very top of the steel mesh netting at the top, a small hole opened up and they were able to squeeze out of it.
Some of the animals you can house together in Planet Zoo in the game. Not every species needs to be kept apart. Is that the case in real zoos?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, some of my favorite things to do there are create mixed species exhibits where sometimes it's a solo animal, like a tiger or something, is a solitary animal, so it doesn't want to have friends. But animals that are herd animals, they want to have friends around. So not only do they have friends of their own species, they have other animals in the exhibit to interact with and explore and different smells and that kind of thing. So that's absolutely the case, especially in herbivore kind of exhibits.
What animals go together? Are there any animals you wouldn't expect going together but actually work fine?
Yeah, one interesting case is our cheetahs. So cheetahs are extremely high-strung animals. Like, they are nervous in lots of situations. They're very skittish. And we use our behavior department uses cheetahs as animal ambassadors. So they're out on walking around the zoo with two keepers usually. Holding on to a harness just in case one was to lose a grip or something like that. So that even puts them into situations that could make their high-strung nature, kind of be set off at any time. They might not necessarily go after a guest or something like that, but be in a situation where they don't feel good and try to leave that situation. So our cheetahs we actually raise with dogs, like domestic dogs. So that it works. Again, I'm not in this department, so I'm not 100% sure how it works, but the dogs, the theory is that the dogs help calm the cheetah down. They're kind of like a companion animal, an emotional support animal. And usually they're with the same dog. The dog is with the same cheetah their entire lives. So that animal becomes somebody that they can look to for, let's say they're out in the public and the cheetah senses something that's going to set it off. They can look over the dog and see the dog is totally calm. So that makes the cheetah think that, everything is okay. They leave the dog and the cheetah alone. They're totally fine. You would think that maybe the cheetah might want to eat the dog or at least not put up with it. But that's probably the unlikeliest combo that I've ever seen work.
In Planet Zoo, if you aren't keeping your zoo in good condition, protesters can appear and they'll pick at the enclosures. Is that something that happens in any zoo that you've worked in?
Yeah, absolutely. That happens at every zoo. But at the Woodlands Park Zoo, I can tell you specifically, there we no longer have elephants there. And one of the reasons for that is protesters. There was a group, or they probably even still exist, called the Friends of the Woodland Park Zoo Elephants. And they would show up pretty much every day with signs and protesting outside of the zoo.
This is like the elephant in the room, so to speak. Like, a lot of people might say zoos are quite exploitative by nature.
Sure.
Why shouldn't we abolish zoos and just let animals live in the natural world?
Yeah, that's a really difficult question to answer. There's so many reasons why zoos need to exist. First and foremost, we talked about it a little bit, but we're not strictly entertainment institutions anymore. When zoos first came around, I think back in Egypt, even there, like early Egyptian times, there were, quote unquote zoos where rulers would kind of take these magnificent beasts and put them behind bars so people could come and look at them and look at how cool I am because I have a big tiger or an elephant or whatever. But nowadays, good zoos are conservation organizations. They are not only keeping the animals, they are doing actual conservation work in the animals' natural homes, trying to keep the habitat going, trying to replenish populations of the natural habitats. But like I said before, people don't care about things that they can't see, touch, or interact with, right? So I personally feel that zoos are important for that reason. some of the most rewarding parts of my job is when you see one of the bears hanging out in the pool and they've come over and put their paw on the glass, and you see a little girl or boy come up and put their hand on the polar bear paw. They're forming real connections with those animals that we're hoping, you know, foster feelings throughout their life that these animals are important, saving their habitats are important, they're valuable to our planet. So forming those kind of connections and making people care about the animals is extremely important part of the conservation process.
Matt Price, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you for having me. It's a great time. Really appreciate you having me on.
That was Matt Price, zookeeper. If you want to hear Matt tell us more things like how many zookeepers it takes to run a zoo, or how much space a lion is happy to live within, what's the correct procedure if that lion gets out of its enclosure, for example, you can hear the full uncut interview by subscribing to our Patreon. We don't do any adverts on Hey Lesson, so we rely totally on our excellent sponsors and supporters, all of whom get fully unabridged interviews with all of our experts. Matt's is one of the longer ones, and it was very hard to cut down because he told me so many interesting things. So if you're a supporter already, that's definitely worth a listen. You can go to patreon.com/heylesson or click the link in the show notes to find out more.
Can I just say, I thought he was brilliant, and I'm suddenly feeling a massive sense of stolen valor. Because I was like, oh yeah, I used to do part-time work at the zoo. And here's a man who, like, you know, sustains polar bears. And, you know, I just want to make it clear, I was in no way putting myself in that league. And that was back when I was at the zoo. Like, the actual zookeepers were like these Olympian figures that I would get incredibly excited if I got to speak to. Oh, I remember once one of the reptile keepers let me have a quick look at a death adder in a bin. it was like when you're playing Hades and, you know, Zeus gets on the phone and he's like, oh, Zagreus, have the ability to fart electricity. It's on me, you know, touched by
you're
divinity.
Touched by gods. So yeah, he's been through quite a lot of fun things. Have you ever been present during an animal escape?
I was part of a great drill. Where they had a practice for what would happen if the gorillas busted out of Gorilla Kingdom.
What are you supposed to do? I guess what Matt was saying, just the gorillas want to go back inside.
Yeah, pretty much. It's very, very, I mean, you'd hope there's like a mech deployed and, you know, like a klaxon and sedative gas missiles launched in salvos and a thick choking fog. But no, you just stand quietly in a room until the theoretical gorilla has been calmed down and re-entered its enclosure.
How much of what Matt was saying was recognizable to you as a player of Planet Zoo?
It's a tricky one, because I don't think Planet Zoo has 100% fidelity to the business of zoos, but for very practical reasons that I can't really blame Frontier for, because as you guys discussed quite a lot, there are people who are just fundamentally opposed to zoos, and a game about zoos has to be pretty cognizant of how it's presenting itself. And I personally think Planet Zoo has an almost saccharine, utopian, you know, almost a sort of propagandist view of zoos, really. And I am really pro-zoo. You know, I would agree with every one of the points made during the interview, but I think the game over-eggs that pudding a little bit. And again, I understand why.
What do you mean? Like, do no animals ever die or anything?
Well, they do, but nothing. Nature seems like a very fair business in Planet Zoo. And it doesn't really acknowledge, whereas I think it is in many circumstances justifiable and even right to have captive animals. That's not always easy, and I think there are a lot of problems that it's possible to have that aren't necessarily, you know, they're just a bit fixable in Planet Zoo. It's all a little bit clean cut, and it's all happy-go-lucky, and assumes that, you know, that there are no zoos that are run purely for entertainment. And obviously, all good zoos that we're talking about do have a conservation basis, have a research basis, but you know, there's a lot of zoos in the world. I've been to like monstrous roadside establishments in the United States where it's just like 17 tigers in a cage. There's no conservation ethos there. You know, those places are bleak. And Planet Zoo, you know, would, I guess, kind of pushes all that quietly off the stage. So only nice things happen in Planet Zoo. And animals do die occasionally.
You say only nice things happen in Planet Zoo, but I've seen some of the things that you've built in Planet Zoo.
Yes. Using
the terrain tools and the construction tools that you were talking about.
Oh, it's a brilliant venue for surrealism. It's funny, actually, like for someone who really likes animals, a lot of my sandbox gaming often tends to veer drastically towards putting them in purgatory. It is fun with Planet Zoo because it's geared up towards making these sort of paradisical enclosures. But because it offers you so much freedom, you can also do some really broken stuff. And to be fair, you can do it without upsetting the animals, but it looks like they really should be upset. So it's kind of the moral best of both worlds. Your animals in the game, your simulated animals have all their needs met, but it doesn't look right. I put a big floating island like off of Avatar in the sky with big holes in it like Swiss cheese and put a tiger on it. And that tiger could have plunged to its death with one false move at any moment. And yet it didn't. And it was blissfully happy with the whole situation.
Maybe just because it was high and far away from people.
Yeah, to get up to that, you had to go up a spiraling ramp that I think was over a kilometer in length once you factored in the turns.
Just to see the tiger. Yeah. I don't know if that would fly at like San Francisco Zoo or anything.
Well, it was like, like the big staircase in Skyrim round the throat of the world. It's
yeah.
kind of like that. Only the mightiest warriors are privileged with a view of the tiger.
Given you, like, you've mentioned tigers, what other animals have you had in the zoo, and are they difficult to manage in the game?
So Planet Zoo's roster of animals it's both really impressive and really disappointing. And I know I'm balancing everything nice I say about it with something critical, but that's only because I love it and we all hold the things we love to high standards, you know, because we dream about how they could do better. Planet Zoo has got, I forget because there's a new DLC about to come out with some African animals, but about 100 animals, I think. There was a phrase used in the interview, actually, charismatic megafauna, which is a great term, and it describes the animals, well, charismatic and megafauna, e.g. big. So zoos talk about like the big four.
The big charmers.
It's elephants, rhinos, hippos, giraffes, which is sort of the big hitters. And there are animals like those and lions and bears, which are the emblematic wild animals and which people will, you know, be most attracted to go and see. So if you want to be commercially successful as a zoo, you have to have those. And Planet Zoo, obviously, in the list of animals they have stocked their game with, have interestingly followed the same logic as zoos, because people will want to buy the game if they can put the most exciting animals in it. And to most people, the most exciting animals are large mammals. That's why it's a disappointment to me. I've got a lot of time for large mammals. I am one myself. but my favorite animals, the ones that I have a real passion for, aren't. I've got 28 fish tanks at home. I think I've got 17 species of freshwater crustacean. Like, I like odder things, amphibians as well. Adore amphibians. There's one in Planet Zoo.
One amphibian. Is it a frog?
It's the Goliath frog, which is a really sick frog, to be fair. But, you know, it's a shame as well, because if you know anything about desperate conservation situations, you'll know amphibians are really boned.
Yeah, the frogs are having a hard time.
Yeah, it's a nightmare. And it's crushing as well, because a lot of the big mammals, you know, as diligent, environmentally conscious people, we all assume that all of the big majestic animals are under massive threat. But, well, they're not all. Frogs don't get anywhere near that level of attention conservation-wise, and they're really
somebody
struggling.
Think of the frogs.
Well, quite, yeah. And, you know, they're really sort of sideshowed in in Planet Zoo. Not just frogs, but like I think there's six reptiles in the main list of animals. And I'll explain briefly, there's two types of animals. There's habitat animals, which are ones that are actually animated and run around as free agents. Sounds like they're employees, but you know what I mean. And then there's exhibit animals, which you just place boxes, like glass tanks, and you put one in, and it's got a pre-rendered animation. You know, it's the one big of the game for me, because the massive amount of customization that it offers you for everything else. And then for these exhibit animals, just, you know, what color lights do you want in your box? You know, they're just kind of a non-event. You know, they're about as thrilling as one of the burger stands. And that, you know, like I said, with all the fish tanks I've got, I mean, I spend huge proportions of my life carefully arranging rocks in glass boxes.
I know this, especially because any listeners who also listen to the Rock, Paper, Shotgun electronic wireless show that you're on will know that probably 25% of every episode is dedicated to you talking about the fish tanks that you
I'm gradually
for.
Wrestling it over to an aquatics podcast. But, you know, that's the thing. There's a huge amount of fascination to be had from smaller, wetter animals. And, yeah, if it was Planet Zoo, it's all, yeah, it's just big mammals.
Matt talked about, like, those different mammals, and he was saying, like, some get along and others don't. Have the animals in your Planet Zoos been well-behaved when you put them together, like different species together? Have any fights broken out or anything like that?
I think it does a really good job of this. Someone actually, if you do play Planet Zoo, do a search for compatibility matrix, because some genius has made a big spreadsheet showing to what extent all the different animals are compatible with each other. Because they've all, you know, some of them actually get a bonus from being together. So there's a big group of African savanna animals like warthogs, ostriches, springbok and the like, which actually get a bonus from being together. So most Planet Zoo zoos will benefit from having a large savanna exhibit with all of these lads in together. But you got some odd ones as well, where animals, you know, some of them are like, the animals don't get a bonus from being together, but they have completely overlapping habitat requirements. Others have nearly overlapping habitat requirements. So if you make it a good enough habitat that the animals will be in, you know, seventh heaven, whatever they're doing, you can actually move the environmental parameters slightly out of their sort of core preferences in order to accommodate the second species you want in there. And that's no problem at all. So you get some interesting combos like Indian rhinoceroses and gharial, which are one of the reptiles in the game. They're a large Indian crocodile. It's a specialized fish eater. And if you've ever seen it, it looks like someone's just put a normal crocodile in Photoshop and just stretched the nose out comically. It's got like a big stick for a face. Oh, I love gharials. But they can live happily with your Indian rhinos. And why not? I mean, they just eat fish.
Yeah. The rhino's not going to want anything to do with the crocodile. And the crocodile is going to look at the rhino and think, what the hell? I can't eat that.
Yeah. It's just, what is this large hill moving around? So an exhibit with those in looks splendid. So you can do a lot of things with animals that, you know, don't mind each other. I would like there to be more unexpected interactions because, you know, as was already pointed out, not all animals are the same. They have personalities, and something that works 90% of the time might not work some other times. And that isn't addressed in Planet Zoo. Like every animal, whereas they are, honestly, they look alive. Frontier has done an astonishing job. You can just watch them. It passes like, you know, the wildebeest equivalent of the Voigt-Kampff test. You know, they seem like animals, but they all, where it lets itself down is that every one is psychologically identical.
It's not like how Matt was saying, where every individual polar bear has their likes and dislikes when it comes to food. Every tiger in Planet Zoo will like the same things and dislike the same things.
Exactly. If it works for one, it will work for all of them. And that's a shame, because, you know, nature is unpredictable, and I think it would really add something to the game if you would slowly become aware that you had a elephant on your hands. You know? That would be cool.
You are able to breed the animals, though, and you can get animals. I think you can get animals from other players as well. Like, there are online elements of the game that sort of simulate the breeding and buying programs of real zoos, like Matt was saying. Can you explain how that works? I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, so there are two ways of buying animals. There's money and conservation credits, which are an abstracted sort of token of your cachet as a conservation institute. So if you take in rescue animals and rehabilitate them and release them into the world, you get conservation credits. If you breed critically endangered animals and release the offspring into the world, you get conservation credits. And if you want the real, the AAA animals, I guess, the prices are generally in conservation credits. And as you said, there is an online marketplace where players can put their animals on the market and you can buy them. And you know, there is, whereas I said they're all psychologically identical, they're not all genetically identical. There are a basic set of stats that differ, you know, lifespan, fertility, size, things like that. You know, so you can buy like an albino llama from someone playing in Mexico or something like that. And that's quite nice. Are you aware of what happened to the market when the game launched?
Yeah, because I looked this up earlier. There was a mess up with the warthogs. The warthogs were flooding the animal market online or something. Players could only buy warthogs.
Yeah, it was. I can't remember now exactly what the specifics were because they patched it swiftly. But basically, economics happened to it really brutally. Like, people were stockpiling gorillas and stuff to inflate the price. And you just couldn't. Like, you couldn't get a decent animal for love nor money. All you could do as a new player was get the animals that were available for cash listings as a new player, which was basically three animals, ostriches, peafowl, and warthogs. And you would just grind them, just breed hundreds and hundreds of them and spam the sales and, you know, release, you know, just dozens of animals a month into the wild.
Like a warthog hyperinflation.
Yeah, and because you were like mass breeding them as well. Like, yeah, I won't cut corners here. That they were all horribly inbred. And yeah, so you're releasing all these like wheezing cyclopean warthogs into a Serengeti that was just, you know, horizon to horizon with these poor snuffling beasts. And you'd just tip out trucks and trucks more in the hopes that one day you'd have enough conservation credits to get a sickly gibbon.
There is an offline mode now. Like, you don't need to get your animals from other players now.
Oh yeah, that was a brief and beautiful phase.
I do remember you writing about a glitch in the game that meant some animals were becoming massive with all the breeding that was going on.
Yeah, so I was looking through, it's got quite a good in-game encyclopedia, a lot of very on-brand Hay Lesson content. You can actually learn a lot about all the animals in Planet Zoo with this very engaging in-game encyclopedia. But it also includes size records for animals that players have bred. And they're all normal, apart from three exceptions I found. One which was a female ostrich recorded as being, I think, 172 meters tall. Bear in mind the tallest male one was like 2.3 meters or something, completely reasonable. So yeah, that was chilling. There was the largest ever Komodo dragon recorded, also a female actually, with a normal size male, was 0.0 meters.
Wait, the largest or the smallest?
The largest. Which just, I mean, that's one of those questions that just opens a whole nest of other questions. I eventually determined this must have been a Komodo dragon made of photons. The third one, which was horrifying, was a cheetah, which only had a string of alphanumeric characters for names, kind of like a bad faith actor on Twitter. And that cheetah was, I forget the actual number, but its length was six times the diameter of Jupiter's orbit in negative space.
It was minus 6 million billion or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. That imagine a couple of times the solar system, and that's the area that a cheetah is not inside.
I remember it now. Yep.
That's cosmic.
All right. I think that's it for another episode of Hey Lesson. We're out of time. You've been listening to me, Brendan, and my guest this week, Nate Crowley. Thank you once again for coming on, Nate.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Is there anywhere people can follow your work or hear more from you if they thought this Zoom man seems interesting?
Well, I'm on Rock Paper Shotgun, where I do features and that. And you can also find me on Twitter, where I'm at Frog Croakley, FrogCroakley. And I have written a bunch of books, most recently Notes from Small Planets, which is a fictional travel guide to some worlds I've invented, which is out with Harper Voyager. And I just wrote a novel about noted orc Gazgul Thraka for Games Workshop, which was great fun.
I have read Notes from a Small Planet, so I can give it a thumbs up too.
It's good toilet chuckles, that one. Not say it's toilet jokes, but yeah, a great book to have in the bathroom because you can dip in and out.
If you've been enjoying Hail Essen, please consider supporting us. We don't have ads or sponsors, like I say, so every little helps. You can subscribe on Patreon. By the way, I'm talking to the listener now, not to you, Nate.
I was going to say, it's quite a hard sell.
But yes, listener, you can subscribe on Patreon for as little as $2 a month. Aside from feeling good about keeping us going, it'll also give you the uncut interviews that I mentioned. And there are other tiers as well, with other rewards like a monthly bonus episode in which myself and various friends talk about games more casually, with no experts allowed. You can find out how to get those at patreon.com/heylesson or by clicking the link in our show notes or by going to heylesson.net and finding your way from there. A big thank you has to go to all of the show's current patrons. So if you're one of those, you're the best. The patron tiers are themed after animals, so that's thematically appropriate for this episode. Thank you to all the fact rats, the knowledge wolves, the comprehension octopuses, and a special shout out to our incredible questionably wealthy porpoises, Bok Choi, Horrenda Monas, and Milk is Gross and Bad for You. Thank you all for your continued support. We can do any of this without you. Thank you, lastly, of course, to you again, Nia.
My pleasure.
And we'll see you all next time. As always, thanks for listening.